Good evening, heroes.
And welcome to First Watch. I'm James D'Amato.
And I'm Kat Murphy, soon to be Kat Cool.
And we're going to get into that.
Okay.
This is our podcast that was unlocked by our generous Patreon patrons.
Amazing patrons.
Guys, thank you so much for supporting us. This is all happening because you supported us to the point where the show could sustain itself. And as a reward, we at least once a month are going to be putting out an episode of First Watch, which is a podcast where you'll be able to check in with me and Kat about things that are going on in our lives, stuff that we think is interesting in pop culture, and maybe some gaming advice, too.
Maybe some gaming advice. Also, because it is a watch, there will always be a random encounter chance.
Yeah, we definitely have to work that into the show. Kat and I did not discuss that before, but
oh, you don't have to say that. Isn't that awesome?
100% awesome.
Right?
I love it. Oh my god. Yeah.
That's the reason we're taking First Watch is because we're spellcasters and we have to sleep the rest of the time to get our full 8 hours.
This is actually, I don't mind peeling back the curtain a little bit and saying that the reason that we decided on the name First Watch is the very first D&D game that Kat and I played together. Kat played Inway, who you've actually seen.
You guys have met Inway.
You've heard her on the show before. And my first character, Rowan, who was the specialist snowflake.
he was a half-dragon.
He was a half-dragon.
Sorcerer.
With
bichromatic eyes.
Bichromatic eyes. and a dragon arm.
Oh my god.
And he was a sorcerer.
Yeah.
But like, they used to spar verbally all the time.
Because we really liked the whole thing where wizards and sorcerers weren't supposed to like each other.
Yeah, we thought that was great. And our GM, you know, was kind of into that, but the only time where we really got to sit back and just roleplay, not worrying about combat or a story, was on the watch.
On the watch, at least for the first few episodes, until we had a city, and then all we did for a long time was shop.
Shop. Yeah. Well, shopping is great. Shopping is the cornerstone of role-playing.
Oh, God.
But yeah, those watches were some of the most interesting sessions. Like, even when we were in town staying at a tavern, I really remember very vividly the time where somebody had cast Zone of Truth, and our characters had to be honest about, like, their emotions and feelings.
Yep.
And, like,
oh my god,
it was great. And it was all during what was otherwise a very normal D&D 3.5 game, is that we had these moments of real down-to-earth role-playing. And I think you see a lot of that on campaign. That's pretty much the whole show sometimes.
Yeah, it's so weird that this is going to be going on nebulously in the future, but the week's episode that we are editing today to go out...
episode 31.
It just... Thank you. They are numbered.
Yeah.
That all happened in the space of... I told them to sleep. They decided that was going to happen in a really complicated way, and the whole thing got away from us.
Yeah. That's some of the magic about role-playing, and especially playing with Johnny and JPC, is that I feel empowered to explore those moments. I feel like I'm not going to be boring anybody at the table, which is...
Oh, absolutely not. And definitely not me. You know that I have no problem with there being downbeats in our action, especially if they lead to ghost adventures.
But yeah, so First Watch is always represented something special to us because it's how Kat and I really discovered role-playing together. We were already excited about D&D, and I don't think Kat or I will shy away from saying that we love 3.5 and we love the granular crunch that really didn't work very well and got out of control really quickly.
But no, it's perfect.
The thing that we do on One Shot all the time, the role playing, we really discovered that on our own because the idea of watch was introduced to us and we had to do something with it.
Yep.
And that something was talk to each other in character. So yeah, we're going to be dividing this into different segments. It's very closely modeled after shows that I love. So if you're a big fan of different podcasts...
Where people just talk to each other about stuff going on instead of playing games.
Yeah, you'll probably notice some similarities in the format.
Cool.
So with that, let's go to our segment that we're going to be doing every time we do this, which Kat very aptly named...
Scry and Buy.
Scry is where you get to look in on our lives, and Kat and I will basically talk about what's top of mind for us this month, or, you know, whenever, whatever the interval ends up being for this show, you'll be able to connect with us and learn more about that. And buy.
Buy is recommendations of things that we've usually recently bought or otherwise encountered related to pop culture, not just gaming, but oftentimes gaming.
Stuff that we think this week.
Yeah. Well, stuff that we think's interesting and think you guys will think is interesting.
Well, with that, let's dive right in. And Kat, you started off introducing the show. Why don't we scry in on you?
I don't know, man. It's your birthday's coming up.
Okay.
This week.
Okay. You had the bigger deal, so.
Well, which is why we should build up to mine.
Okay.
See?
Okay.
Yeah.
So my birthday is June 14th, which is Flag Day, if you are keeping track of obscure holidays.
Which James is if they're related to the United States of America.
God bless America.
Because for some reason he's like that.
God bless America, everyone.
Ugh, gross.
I actually always felt like kind of special growing up that my birthday was Flag Day. I felt that provided me a special connection to the country. that is completely honest. Naked honesty that you are laughing at.
We aren't even in a zone of truth right now.
Yeah, we're not in a zone of truth, but that's the real stuff.
That's the real for real.
And my birthday weekend is actually going to be kind of toned down. I think my actual birthday celebration this year is going to be on Halloween.
Oh, cool.
Because that is my night of 10,000 nights.
Yes.
That is when, on October 31st, I will have been alive for 10,000 days and 10,000 nights. So, got to celebrate that.
Yep. That's, we've had a project we've wanted to do with Halloween for a long time that's kind of spooky. And that just might come true on that night, James.
We might be able to do that night. But if we don't, we'll at least have a party.
Yep. Until then, look forward to cryptic updates.
Cryptic updates.
Halloween creep 2K15.
But I am going to be running a game for our fan. This is actually the first birthday game that we're going to do. And the reason that this one is happening before all of the others is partially because of the birthday, but this person contacted us and they were willing to pay a lump sum outside of what they were already contributing to Patreon to get a game for a birthday. Like, they were at $25 a month.
Yeah.
If I told them, if you increase, up to the $50 a month, because it's going to turn, they were offering like $300 to $400 for me to run the game. And I was like, it's going to work out to be about the same anyway. And you'll be helping the Patreon. So we'll get closer to that 3000 goal. And, that just made sense to them. So I'm going to be running Feng Shui.
Cool. Feng Shui 2.
Feng Shui 2.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a really fun adventure. They're going to be fighting Nazis in the underworld.
Oh, and this will have already happened by the time
this
goes up.
This will have already happened by the time this goes up.
Don't spoil.
Yeah.
No, what if they're listening?
And if they consent to it, and that's why I'm not naming any names. Uh-huh. If they consent to it, it will end up in the secret archive.
Oh, very cool.
And if they don't, and like everybody who gets a birthday game or like the quarterly games that Kat and I are going to do, you have the freedom to not consent to it being recorded. But, if you don't mind it, it'll end up in the secret archive and that'll just be a recorded thing that you guys can enjoy.
I don't know. I think that the community building aspect of getting to talk to you guys and then getting you guys to talk to each other is pretty neat. I would love to continue building an army.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Well, what I'm saying is that if people don't feel comfortable on mic, they don't have to.
Fine, but if you do, then everyone will know you.
Yes, exactly. So, I am going to be doing that. I'm very excited about that. And then on my birthday proper, we're just going to be recording an episode of Campaign.
We're just recording three episodes of Campaign.
Three episodes, at least three. I would prefer four.
I would as well. But we also have to get through a bunch of campaign letters and things.
So yeah, that's true. That's true. Then that could be extra episode
hopefully
content.
Hopefully we'll get through four. It's going to be an exciting four. I'm really looking forward to these.
That's
ones.
Actually something interesting that I maybe we could talk about it later in the episode about the format for Campaign that I find interesting, because there were two episodes recently where I felt there were really great points to end the episode.
But we couldn't. Yep.
So we'll talk about that a little bit later. I think that's actually a great thing to talk about on the show.
Absolutely.
So that's my scry. So let's head into
Do you want to do your buy or shall we do the buy later?
The way Chris and Matt do theirs, they do their checks.
How do you
want to
do it, though?
Let's split them up.
Okay.
Let's split them up.
Okay. So my scry is that I am getting married next week. I'm going to stop being Cat Murphy and start being Cat Cool. I think it's totally awesome whenever people, no matter what people do with their names, I think it's really cool.
Yeah.
Murphy means a lot to me, so I'm going to be sliding it into my middle name. Goodbye, middle name.
So now you have four names.
No, no, I'm not going to. Oh, well, I don't know.
Are you kicking out the old middle name?
Yeah, I don't. You can't have two middle names. Can you?
I do.
No, you have a confirmation name. That's a different thing.
That still goes in the middle.
Not in your legal name.
Certainly doesn't go in the end.
Not in your legal name.
I could start writing that in anytime.
And it's always kind of been frustrating to me that my full middle name doesn't fit in middle name slots on like standardized tests and things. So this will.
Yeah, because you're going to be taking so many more of those. So that's important.
Shut up. No, that's how, I don't know. That's kind of an Irish tradition, too.
Oh, it's to slide out. Okay, that's,
No, it's not to slide out. They leave it blank. Mm. And then they can put the slot in there. I always figured I'd keep whatever name sounded best. And Cat Cool, man.
Cat Cool does sound real good.
Both spelled with Ks. Nothing bad there.
Yeah.
And I like the idea of John and I sounding like a team, you know?
Yeah. I think that's great. The only thing that I am going to miss is the meter of your name.
Cat Murphy.
I really like one syllable, two syllables.
Yeah.
That's always been cool, but Cat Cool speaks for itself.
Yeah, and you have enough syllables in your name to cover
make
for
up
us.
For everybody.
So I have been up to my elbows in that. There's like a whole lot to do with weddings. I don't know if any of you know that. It's like a thing. And I'm not even...
Yeah, you're keeping it real low-key.
I'm keeping it super low-key. I don't care about weddings at all. So we're having a private ceremony. Just the two of us and an officiant, because that's legal in Chicago. And then afterwards, we're having a dinner with like 40 people max. You know,
you
it's a real small thing.
You don't even need the officiant. You just need to say the officiant's there.
No, they have to put like stamps and things.
Well, yeah, I mean, what you could do is have anybody who's like ordained or, you know, who's empowered
already,
to sign this paper.
Okay.
Yeah, you already paid the man.
I already, yeah, it's all
saying,
worked out.
I'm just saying you can cut out the middleman.
Mm. Well, we didn't because it was a lot easier to do it this way.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, and it's...
I'm glad it's like... Kat is always a person who takes on a lot of projects, so it is good whenever she finds efficiency in any project that she's doing.
I'm really looking forward to that. I'm really looking forward to all of the prep work being over, because like even though it's that small, there's a lot to do. That's their little table bouquet things to make. Gotta finish putting together. I need to get a clutch purse. John needs to get shoes. I gotta finish making the presents that I'm giving everyone. Stuff like that, you know?
We get presents?
You get presents. That's normal.
Now I have to get you presents. Really good ones.
not required at my dealio.
It's 100% required that I get it, period, though. Okay. Regardless.
So that's happening. I feel like it's a pretty boring thing to listen to.
It's not boring. I am actually really looking forward to your Tumblr and Instagram updates when all the decorations are in place.
Oh.
Because Kat... I am Kat's man of honor. Kat has been showing me the decorations that are going to go up, and they look cool.
I hadn't even been thinking about taking pictures of them, but I should, shouldn't I?
You...
I'm sorry.
Weren't you trying to hire a photographer?
No, so I'm going to have a photographer. He's also not like a professional. He's just a dude who's pretty cool.
Yeah. A mercenary.
Yes. But no, just in terms of like putting stuff up on the tumbles.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not particularly sentimental about this sort of thing.
Oh, you know what? I think it's a neat thing for people to see, especially because you are trying to keep your wedding low-key and private. And I think that is something unique about how you're approaching your wedding. And it's probably an experience that is going to be kind of common to some millennials. Like,
yeah.
Generally speaking, the concept of marriage, like I know I'm going to get married to somebody.
Yep.
That's expensive. And I'm trying to do this with my life, which is also really expensive.
Yeah.
So what a wedding is going to be to me is probably not what I saw weddings as in other people. And I think it's important to have somebody like you out there being like, hey, this is what I did.
Maybe I'll do a thing about, maybe I'll even do a thing about what stuff costs and the amount of time it took to put things together, just so that other people who are thinking about having a really low key thing know that it's still going to be a few $1,000s.
It's still tough. Yeah.
And what it looks like as, but hey, it's not the 30,000 plus baseline for the average wedding these days.
Oh my God. That's a car.
Yeah. It's not good.
I think that's cool. Is there anything that you're nervous about? Like, I know there are plenty of things that you are stressed about.
Yeah, but anything that I'm nervous about? Not really. Honestly, the only thing that I have one thing that I don't want to happen, and James and I were just playing a game about this. I don't want to have a migraine on the day before the day of the event. I'll still be able to handle it if I do, because I can push through those things when the time comes. But I just want to not have that be an issue. That would be really nice. Otherwise, I guess I'm a little nervous about being present in the moment, because I have a tendency to, I guess, withdraw. You know, that social situations that are too big can get overwhelming. And while this is small, it has a lot of pressure on it. My mom likes pretty things, and I want it to be as pretty as possible for her, and that's a source of stress, you know? So it's like the follow through of watching people experience that can sometimes push me to the outside of the group. But I really just want to be present in every moment, and I'm sure that I will, because I'm excited to be married to John. I'm not nervous about any aspect of that. I always figured I wouldn't get married because the legal aspect of marriage isn't very important to me. The thing that's important is...
Well, how is the U.S. government going to know that you love somebody?
The important thing to me is choosing every day to be with that person and support them in a primary, foremost, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And I always thought that the lack of a signed commitment and just the act of choice was more impressive than doing the whole thing. Mm-hmm. But you know what? It's been fun to get rings and do I really like our rings.
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to having his last name, and it's going to be nice.
I think... permanent objects and things like that. There's no reason to be embarrassed about that thing. The thing that I don't like about weddings is that the event is so temporary and that you spend so much money on something that's not around for a long time. If you're spending money on a ring that's
I'm so excited
forever,
about the rings.
That's great.
Well,
that's
that makes me feel like a wizard, you know, that we have these, we have these rings that go together. They're a set and they have the symbolism, and that totem is something that I do find value in.
What
I think that's
do they
really
empower
cool.
you to transform into?
I am unfortunately form of ice, whatever John turns into.
No!
Yeah, I know.
Come on!
It's the worst one.
It's 2015. We should be past this. Okay, so with that, let's go into our buys.
Onto our buys.
Yep. And for me, we said these wouldn't always be about role-playing games, but that's a huge part of my life. And I recently bought a slew of indie role-playing games just because I was interested in them. I didn't even use the show's budget for this. I did put them into the indie RPG Dropbox that has all of the games that we own, which are... It's a crazy amount of games.
We own a lot of games.
I don't know if you have the logins for this, but
just
it's
the Dropbox?
Staggering. Cool. Now, I've been cruising Bundle Holding recently. I picked up the Trail of Cthulhu from that.
Can I put my comic PDFs in there?
It's not a Dropbox. I'm saying Dropbox.
Sure.
This is going to be a plug for a company that's already giant, but they help out a lot of indie publishers, so I don't mind it. Drive-Thru RPG. It's a great way to buy RPG PDFs and, printed volumes as well. That's where I get most of my books, because they have, something called My Library, which everything you buy, you can download from there or put into a Dropbox.
That's awesome.
So I have near closing in on 100 books in there. But that's a lot from Bundle of Holding, which is a great thing that if you don't know about, it's a charitable organization that sells digital role-playing books. And they are usually full sets of systems or different cool indie collections. And I cruise there all the time to see if there's anything I'm interested in. So like I said, I picked up the Trail of Cthulhu recently, and Also, Knight's Black Agent had a sale recently. But what I wanted to talk about most of all was the indie games that I got. And I didn't get them all through Bundle of Holding, which is unfortunate. But the first I want to talk about are games designed by Emily Carabas. Emily Carabas is going to be have her games featured on our show soon. She does a lot of romance games.
Oh, yay!
And that's something that that's a subject that Kat and I have always been very interested in. And I'm actually planning a Critical Success episode that's going to be coming up.
I saw that. Well, is it about romance games? Because it was labeled sex.
It's romance and sex. Okay. Because I think they go hand in hand.
Well,
and I think people, a lot of times in game, avoid romance because they're afraid of sex.
That makes sense.
And I don't think people should be afraid of either.
Right.
So I'd like to talk about that a little bit. But Emily Carabas has designed a bunch of great games. Shooting the Moon and Breaking the Ice are two games that are relatively inexpensive. I think I know you're definitely going to see Shooting the Moon on the show in the future. And I can only imagine Breaking the Ice is going to show up at some point as well. So, check that out and check out games designed by her. And the other one I wanted to give a quick shout out to is A Tragedy in Five Acts. This is a game that I have not played yet, but it is designed by Jenna Fowler and Jeremy Costeau.
Costeau?
Costeau?
Probably.
It's with a K.
Oh, well, how is it spelled?
It is K-O-S-T-I-E-W. Was I right? I could be right. I could be wrong.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm willing to accept either. But it is a game where it's a competitive game where characters are competing to be the primary protagonist in a Shakespearean tragedy.
Yes.
So you want terrible things to happen to your character.
That's so good.
It's very much like a role-playing version of Gloom. And although I have not read the full rules yet, I'm very excited to see how they accomplish this.
Yeah, I really like that. As someone who's pretty into Shakespearean tragedy.
Yeah.
That's going to be great.
Yeah, that's going to be a lot of fun. So that's my buy.
Cool. My buy is to books.
Book books
as compared to game books or comic books, other types of books that we will often discuss. So the first is one most people have probably read before. It's The Wonderful Wizard of Oz.
Oh.
I haven't read it before, and I kickstarted Evan Dom's illustration of it because I just really thought that he was doing something cool with the art. The book came through. I've been reading it. It's such a delight. It's such a light, happy read. And
oh, that's great.
Something that I didn't know about it that I think is really cool is that was really, really intentional on the part of the author because they loved Grimm's tales, but they thought they were needlessly dark in an age where school systems teach children to not fall down a well on right. their own without needing a fear of a monster in the well. Right. So,
okay.
So it's supposed to be something that's just like fantasy for the sake of fun and entertainment, which is cool, as a product of its time. And it reads like that. It's like super enjoyable. And it's got me thinking a lot about the modern needs of small child fantasy in that way of what is lacking in their education.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
And I guess like I don't even. The way we do small child books these days is so different than stories, you know?
Yeah, but it doesn't need to be.
Right.
So that's a cool thing.
Hmm.
And then the other book that I am reading is Monster Theory, Reading Culture by Jeffrey Jerome Cohen, which is what you think it is. It's it's essays about monsters, representations of different cultural others in them, and how to decipher texts with monsters in them. And it's been good. It's been an interesting read. I'll have more for you guys when I'm done with that one. There'll probably be a bunch of theoretical monster books that I read over the course of this thing. So at some point we should delve into them and talk about which books are good, which books aren't so great, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
This isn't that episode. This is the first episode.
Yeah, well, we have plans. We've got plans for the future. That's important.
Yeah, I guess I'm also reading Combiner Wars, if anyone else is reading Combiner Wars, as a part of my fledgling Transformers gig.
Yeah, is that relevant to the robots that turn into vehicles?
Would you call Cybertronians robots? I don't know.
According to the recent G.I. Joe versus Transformers, Cybertron is a nonsense word used to explain a toy line that really doesn't make much sense.
Yeah, that's That's really funny.
Yeah, you should check that out.
I love
it's
how...
It's a great comic.
I love everything I've seen about it, and I adore that the Cybertronians don't speak English. Like, it makes me really happy that they just speak in cool waveforms. Anyway, Starscream's the best.
Okay.
Moving on.
Let's, yeah. Let's save that for our deep dive on Starscream.
On Starscream?
Segment.
Oh, no.
But I think that actually covers it for Scry and Buy. So let's move on to our next segment. All right. So let's move on to our next segment, which we are calling Knowledge Dungeoneering.
Am I supposed to react? Ooh.
Well, that was horrible. So Knowledge Dungeoneering, and actually I think the knowledge section is where Kat and I are just going to talk about an area that we happen to have a lot of experience or knowledge in, or that we've just been having really in-depth conversations about, and we wanted to invite our heroes in on the conversation.
Typically, this will relate directly to gaming. If not, it will be about a tertiary topic, and then we'll later discuss how we think the concepts we've grappled with relate to gaming, or you can use in, or how you can use them in your games.
All right, so let's get started. Kat, since this was your idea, or this week's subject was your idea, I thought you should introduce it.
Okay, well, this week we are going to be discussing genres of games and why I think the current way we've been handling it to date isn't enough. And that's a weird title. So I'll explain kind of how we got there. It's something I've been thinking about for a while. And on James's and my combined birthday, which is June 19th.
June 19th, taking June from my month and 19th from Kat's day.
Smashing them together. My birthday's in July. We went out and we saw Inside Out together.
Which was a lot of fun.
It was so much fun. For those who haven't seen it, we're not going to give anything away. Go see it. It's Pixar. You know, they did good.
Yeah, even when they do bad, they do good. And this time, they just did good. They just did good and did good.
They just did a good job.
Good did just did good.
Good did just. Such that immediately, as soon as we stopped watching, James and I turned to each other and started discussing how we could turn the movie into a game. I think it's obvious. I think we need to do Everyone is Riley, Riley being the main character of Inside Out.
Yeah, and there are some techniques, or there are little game mechanics, and maybe we could talk about that later, of how we decided to gamify that. But we haven't actually taken the time to sit down and write that yet, so let's stay on topic.
Yeah, but more than that, we started talking about emotional content in games, which reminded me of this post on Tumblr I saw a little while back and thought about a lot, which was just about fan fiction and fiction and the Dewey Decimal System. A lot of literature aimed at men or upheld by men, specifically not fan fiction, is categorized in terms of genre. There's, aside from just general fantasy, there's sci-fi, there are all of these like groups of world-building concepts that go into defining what that area of fiction is. And to date, that is what I have seen the majority of role-playing books do. I see a lot of setting books, and most of the systems that I care most about tackled one of those concepts, like cyberpunk, or fantasy, or steampunk, and sort of went with it from a setting out perspective. James, do you think that's fair?
I think that that's definitely a fair assessment of that.
So the post just went on to call out how fan fiction doesn't really do that, though. I mean, like, there's an element of, yes, it's taking place in this general genre, but since it's fan works, there's no need to, like, dive into the genre. Everyone more or less knows what they're
yeah,
going into.
You're, like, not going, oh, I'm going to read a sci-fi fan fiction. You're going, I am going to read a Starship Troopers fan fiction.
Right. I'm going to read a Batman fanfiction. But you don't even do that for the most part. If you're a discerning fanfic reader, you go in going, I want to read a Mad Max coffee shop AU that's fluff. right? So Mad Max kind of already got the genre out of the way, but then we're dealing with two concepts, coffee shop AU.
Which that completely changes the genre, I would like to point out.
It does. It completely changes the genre. So whatever themes that were outwardly present in the apocalyptic landscape of Mad Max are now gone. We're just dealing with the same broken characters. We have to justify those character elements in a different way. As a coffee shop AU is just people hanging out in a coffee shop in a modern standard setting. Then the most important thing, I think, though, is the fluff. Fluff is feel-good, happy, cuddly times. It defines the emotion that the fic expects to generate in the reader while they're reading it. I don't read things that are going to make me sad when I don't want to read them. Fanfic writers let me know ahead of time when a fic is supposed to make you sad. But sometimes they do want to be sad, so I specifically search out those fics. And I haven't seen other types of fiction do this.
Yeah, I will agree. I think there are certain movies that we know, like, oh, this movie is a tearjerker and it's a drama, but I don't think it's how we categorize a movie. It's sort of like how we discuss an event that happens in a movie.
Right. Whereas that's different in reading. When you read something, your body experiences all of the feelings as if you were doing the actions of the characters. It's part of why we love reading so much. You know, that's and why we nerds, hopefully you nerds listening, like fantasy. You know, that it makes us feel a lot of things that we just don't have access to in the typically urban setting that we live in. It lets us do phenomenal things. But sometimes what's really cool is that, like, again, with fan fiction, all you want to do is feel in love or feel sad or feel hurt and then be comforted. Hurt comfort's a really interesting genre, I think, because it's like such a specific, bizarre thing in which someone was injured and either you are helping them get through that or someone is helping you get through that, you know?
Yeah, actually, let's lay out some of the more unusual genre tags that get put on fan fiction because, well, you and I are very knowledgeable about fan fiction. I believe many people in our audience may not be up to speed, so to speak, with what we know.
Oh, how weird. Okay. So there's Hurt Comfort, which I just described, a story in which someone undergoes a tragic event and someone helps them through that situation. Angst is sad. Jen is typically cute nonsense.
It's something that Jen is what you would expect to see in whatever fandom that you would be reading it from. So if you're reading a Mad Max fic, a Jen fic in that would be Mad Max doing a car fight, right?
Oh, disagree entirely. No. Jen, you can have a Jen coffee shop AU. Jen is just that there isn't a specific emotion attached and you are to read it like a novel. It can undergo different things, but it's generally lighter. Yeah, so I actually really like Jen because there's no reason to write a Jen fic unless you had an interesting piece of characterization you wanted to work with. That's what I feel.
Okay.
Family is interesting because you're looking at people kind of realize that they think of each other as family. Cough, Minok, Krill.
Well, and then
our weird self-insert Star Wars fan fiction.
Well, and there's this, yeah, it's the most bizarre self-insert. Well, there's self-insert as a genre. That is the Mary Sue genre or the genre famous for having Mary Sues, where typically the author is inserting themselves or another original character that is a simulacrum for themselves into their favorite fictional franchises. And there's also alternate universe, which Kat has been bringing up. We understand what a coffee shop AU is, but alternate universes span a lot of different things. Another popular AU for people to see is post-apocalyptic. And that would be, you know, taking a show that typically doesn't take place in a post-apocalypse and putting it there.
Typically a zombie apocalypse.
Because zombies are so, so prevalent. And there's also Grimdark, which is super famous. That is taking something that you know and like, a franchise that you know and like, and putting the DC editorial staff in charge of that. And usually hands get cut off and people start doing heroin and swinging around dead cats. That happens in 9 out of 10 Grimdark fix.
So there's all of that stuff. There are tons and tons of genres of fan fiction that are focused on more of this emotional content. There are other things that describe different elements to the fic, which is why if you look at a fanfic categorization, it tends to be a lot of keywords kind of strung together because there's a lot going on. It's more nuanced than any one title can typically handle, which I think is all very interesting. I want to talk about a second type, which is fanfic genres based on cliches that we find interesting. This is something James and I actually like a lot, and it's part of what went into Epiphany. This is something like Body Swap, or let's see, what are some other good ones? Pretend Relationship, one where someone's parents are coming over and they're like, they think I have a boyfriend. Please pretend to be my boyfriend. But over the course of the thing, they fall in love.
Two Places at Once, where you've got two obligations and you try to do them both and they start to overlap and cause stress.
These are all types of fics that are really, really prevalent, and people don't even disguise the fact that the plot is going to adhere to that really trite, played out thing.
In fact, the tag is telling you that is promising you that it will do exactly that.
But, like, I think I have read every single Beast Boy Raven Body Swap that exists because it's really fascinating to me. I love how people handle it. I love when people handle it well. I love when teens just handle it poorly. Everything about it is just top-notch to me. And it made me realize that that's really gamic. I'm watching people fulfill a very specific patterned thing and getting a specific type of enjoyment out of it that can easily be replicated into a game.
Yeah, and actually, especially with the last things that you have mentioned, it kind of disappoints me that we don't see more games support those tropes, because we see a lot of games, as you mentioned at the top, supporting genres and settings. But not so many games that are there specifically supporting those quirky event tropes.
Well, but event tropes, yes. I think that those are the easier ones to do. I'm really interested in games that are meant to help you, or that are meant to put you in a specific emotional place and play that out. I don't know about all you guys, but sometimes I like to cry. It makes me feel good, and I like feeling sad in a safe way that has nothing to do with things going on in my life. And having a game where everybody knew that that's what was going on and we played through it would be fantastic. I'm not a huge LARP person. I know that some of this takes place there, but I haven't seen it around my table yet. I haven't seen a tabletop game that's just like, this is the angst game. It has specific things that, like, mechanics that gear you towards experiencing an angst adventure. It is buoyed by these additional tropes, play out angst. But I did used to do a lot of role-playing like this. When I was a teenager, I used to hang out with girls on the internet, just in, like, chat rooms. We'd pretend to be characters that we liked from a thing, or sometimes original characters, and we'd act out scenarios together that were either supposed to be just romantic or sad or fun, something like that, that was definitely getting at the emotional content of the scene more so than any of the genre stuff happening in the world.
So I guess my question is, as somebody who has not, I haven't introduced this to my table. I've never played any game, I think, for specific emotional play. I've played them all for the game. How would we introduce this to a table, and how does it start to change the way we play?
Right. So I think we need new games, and we need a dialogue about the types of emotions we're all expecting to feel throughout games or want to engage with. Because it's weird to put someone in a sad place when they don't want to be sad. You know, that's part of what's cool about reading fanfic. It's pick and choose. In larger sweeping story games, we sort of know that we're going to have ups and downs. But we're seeing a lot of really small games these days. Mm-hmm. I think that there can be small games that help you get at those small experiences between friends at a table instead of just anonymously online, you know, with subpar role players like I used to. I think, golly, how to explain this? Part of what I'm trying to do is broaden the voices of people contributing to games. I want to know what people who are just role-playing out emotional scenes and writing fan fiction could bring to the table if they were told that there was a space for an emotional game like that here, and that they'd be welcomed instead of shunned.
Yeah, absolutely. Monster Hearts comes to mind, and although we played it for comedy, that is a game that you could absolutely play for angst if you wanted to play for angst. All of those abilities on your character sheet basically set up tensely dramatic situations. And even though we haven't featured it on one shot yet, Drama System by Robin Laws is knee-deep in that sort of interaction, in that it's more about the people and their relationships with each other and how different events affect those relationships than it is about accomplishing tasks.
Yes, and I think that those are really cool steps, because they're taking like the idea of a smaller thing and bringing it up to a broader game. All I'm saying is I want more, and I want more nuance. I want to be able to pick the coffee shop AU, you know, her comfort game to play with my lady friends who don't want to play the Star Wars RPG with me because they're too intimidated. And I'm interested in taking that on with other people, about finding what people think about this and how mechanically you would express not general emotions, but those specific emotions. Does that make sense?
Sure, yeah. Well, what for you differentiates taking an established gaming system and setting up a hurt comfort scenario rather than having a game system that is specifically trying to gamify hurt comfort, I guess, is my question then.
So I think that that's kind of the difference between playing a romance game and having romance in your game.
Mm-hmm.
You know that, one, you fully expected it, and all of the mechanics serve it. You know what you're getting into before you started doing it, and I always feel pretty confident in those scenarios. But if you chuck romance at me in your average game, even a game that I really like, I'm probably going to get nervous about not doing it well enough, because I wasn't in a place where I was thinking that I'd have to be doing it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and this sort of goes into, I think, a theory of something that we've expressed on the show before, is we think game design is important, and one of the reasons we feature all these different systems on the show is we think each one brings something different to the table. And something like Monster Hearts is better for doing angst than something like D&D, because D&D doesn't have any tools for it, because it's about killing monsters and getting gold.
Right. And that's not to say I want to stop playing, you know, these larger games, but I do want to make the most out of all of those emotional moments in the sorts of games where I can tell it's supported by the rest of the players. And I think the only way to gain confidence in doing those sorts of things is to play them. I don't feel comfortable playing them in the game systems that already exist. I would like ones that teach me how to be better at it.
Well, I think there are a lot of game systems out there, probably some that the audience don't know about, and definitely ones that we personally might not know about, that are providing this and filling some of these niches.
Absolutely. So hit us up. Let us know. We know about a bunch of romance games.
Let's talk about some games that actually, that we know about, that our audience could find that would support these different styles of play, that would support this emotional play. And I think we already mentioned Drama System. Drama System is something that is, once again, very focused on relationships between characters and sort of providing an unstable, very tense and fraught environment to see those relationships develop, see how they change, and see how people relate to each other. There's a lot that you could do with that. If you want to do your, I don't think this is quite the best for doing your coffee shop AU, but it is good for doing a high school AU. If you want to take familiar characters that have really intense relationships in like a superhero genre, if you want to take the Teen Titans, I guess Teen Titans are a terrible example. If you want to take the Justice League and you want to put them in a high school drama system, it's a really fun way to do it. And it's a great way to do it without having to deal with the baggage of these guys being superheroes. They're not superheroes anymore. They're just people that feel ways about each other and have different ways of thinking. And so if you're looking to do something like this and do this emotional play, drama system is a great way to do it in a way that plays with conflict and makes conflict safe and fun while still dealing with personalities that you love.
And then we know a bunch of two-player romance systems. James, for a while, was looking for some two-player games we could play. If you listen to 14 Days, I think that's the first one we had on the show. And we specifically wanted to start with something non-romantic. But along the way, we found a bunch of cool romance games. James, do you have a list of them?
I do have a short list. So let's look at a bunch of different games about romance. And I think you cannot discuss romance in games without talking about Emily Kerr Boss. She's a really talented designer who's been doing a lot of really cool different systems. And one that I want to bring up is Breaking the Ice. This is a role-playing system where you are playing two characters having their first three dates. And you're sort of discovering whether or not these characters are a good fit for each other. And it helps players by having you reward behaviors that your character likes and discouraging behaviors that your character doesn't like, basically providing mechanical support for experiences that you would normally have if you were going on dates with somebody. It's a really great system, I think, to build an idea of who a character is, and it's a great collaborative thing. It's also super intimate. Emily Kerr Boss has stated that this is a game that is a good game to play with somebody when you are trying to pick them up. You know, it's essentially, it's a game where you're sitting across from another person, you're staring them in the eye, it's just you talking to this other person, and like, you're kind of going on three dates with them. Even though it's your character, you're dating this person, and
that's super, like, actually using a game to try to do that is so insane to me.
Well, I mean, like, it's insane, I think, until you actually take a look at Breaking the Ice. Because Breaking the Ice is just, like, providing you the premise, oh, we're playing a game, but you're also sort of navigating a relationship together.
No, absolutely. My point isn't that there's anything wrong with that or the game. My point is that in playing the game, you're in a fan fiction in which you are, you know, being a love god, artificing your own relationship. Does
yes.
that make sense?
Yes, yes. It certainly is. Let's move on to the next one, which is called A Place to Fuck Each Other. This is something that was recommended to me by Alex Roberts, one of the hosts of the Tabletop Superhighway podcast. She is a connoisseur of romantic games. And
oh, cool.
This is one of her favorite games of all time. It is a game where the premise is you are playing two queer women. And actually, this is not a two-player game. This is a three-player game where you have two people who are trying to get together, whether that is hooking up to fuck or moving in with each other. And the third player is playing an outside force that is trying to keep you apart.
Which is so good. What a fun premise for a game.
It's an incredibly fun premise for a game. I kind of fell in love with it, when I first heard the premise, and reading it, it's only better. And it's like such a small, simple game, but there's a lot you can do with it. The outside force, it can be something so like literal as these are two women at a party who want to hook up, and there's a third wheel friend that's getting in between them. Or it can be a lot more complex, like you have two women who want to move in with each other and work is driving them apart. You know, maybe one works nights, one works days. It's a really fascinating game. Yeah, so this is Avery McNaldno. They also wrote Monster Hearts, which is a game that we love. They also did A Quiet Year, which is another game that I bet we'll love and is very popular.
I think they have it. Yeah, we need to play that.
Yeah, the design here in A Place to Fuck Each Other is incredibly solid, and it is a wonderful game. It's something that you can do for the straight romance, for intense drama, or for sheer comedy, because there's nothing funnier than two people that want to be together and something is keeping them apart.
We need to play that.
Oh,
like, we need to play it just now. It's
definitely
so much fun.
And, you know, one of the things that Alex pointed out that she loves about it, and I certainly love about it too, is that it is a game about queer women, like specifically. Obviously, yeah. You can hack this to do whatever. It's just great that this is also a game that is putting people in a space where they might be identifying with somebody that who they don't normally think like. And there are a lot of ways to find familiar comfort in role-playing, but I love it when a role-playing game challenges you to stretch yourself a little bit. And finally, we will end with a game that is not two-player, again, but is most certainly about romance, and it is about the end of a romance. It is called It Was a Mutual Decision, and this one's by Ron Edwards. This game is bananas. I really want to start off by saying this game is truly bananas. It is a collaborative game where the group is playing two different people who are in a relationship, and that relationship is ending. The men play the woman, and the women play the men, if you are going to do it in a heteronormative way, which I don't know if the game assumes that, because I haven't read it all the way through. It's just a lot of the art is a heterosexual relationship. I'm sure there's a sidebar for gay queer relationships, but neither here nor there. You're two people breaking up, and also one of you might be a were-rat.
Yes. I remember you first presenting this one to me, and that it was like, it's interesting up until the were-rat, at which point I don't understand how we haven't already played it.
It's what's cool. Like, there's a lot of things, obviously, that are cool about it. Having played Everyone is John, I love the way in collaboration you can still have a lot of different ideas and motivations for people. Everyone is John obviously plays it up to its most comedic, pulpy purposes. However, I often feel, especially when I'm in a fraught situation, like the end of a relationship, I am being pulled in a lot of different directions. There's part of me that wants the safe comfort of being in a relationship and doesn't want to give that up. There's part of me that knows it's time to move on and really wants to push for that. There's part of me that is afraid of hurting the other person and trying to shield them from that. And at different times, like, I'm sure, because I know I felt this when breaking up with people, it feels like they are different people day to day. And this system has an elegant solution for that in that, you know, different people are playing the one person. The were-rat. I am not all the way through this game, but I believe the were-rat is a metaphor for somebody being at fault. In a lot of breakups, you know, we like to imagine there is a hero and there is a villain, and oftentimes we place ourselves in the hero category. Though I know plenty of times where I've placed myself in the villain category. And that's what the were-rat is. You know, somebody could be a were-rat. Somebody could be this dangerous, horrible, gross monster. Or you could both be people who are dealing with a very difficult time in your lives. So those are games where if you are interested in going after an emotion, those are all games about emotions and that have rules to reinforce those emotions.
And what we're asking is, if you're interested in this conversation, as we are, why not check some of them out? Or and if you're checking them out, assess how you think comparatively they handle those different emotions. And if you're gaining something more from one than the other, how do you think playing out emotions in these controlled mechanical ways works out for you? But also, if you've never done it, why not check out some fan fiction? there's a lot that happens in that space that I think that people who've never read any, like, really don't have a concept of what that sort of writing is like. And I think you learn a lot about people, especially girls, by reading it.
My theory is that fan fiction is always, it's the most ridiculous voyeuristic rush that you can get when it is, like, usually when the fan fictions are written poorly, because a person, if you read somebody's diary, people lie in their diaries all the time and are not honest with themselves or honest about different situations. But in fan fiction, people are completely honest because they have the separation of using fictional characters that they know and are familiar with. You can pick up a lot about somebody's headspace and, you know, where they're at just emotionally by reading their fan fiction.
James is specifically talking a lot about bad fic and stuff written by younger people. That remains true for older people. The stuff that I'm most interested in reading.
Oh, Kat, liking her good fan fiction.
Yeah, well, that handle the characterization of characters that, like, typically in canon, here's looking at you comic books, don't always do me right. You know, that I think that the writers currently in charge of the property aren't handling things like the way either I'd like to see them or sometimes a lot of people would like to see them. And I think it clues you into areas of fandom, or just being a young woman in America taking on pop culture that without the knowledge of, like, it tells you what they want and what they wish things were and where the gaps are. Since I'm interested in exploring the gaps in gaming, I think this is a part of that conversation.
Well, that's great. So I think people have a lot to think about in terms of if you're a fan fiction fan, how fan fiction is categorized and how you can apply that designing your games at home. Are you going to create an emotional goal and strive towards it? Are you going to talk to your players about perhaps creating that environment? We also highlighted some systems where you can go out and be supported by the system to go after a couple of these emotional genres. And of course, encourage people to go out and partake in fan fiction, as I believe it is very, very close to role playing.
Yeah.
All right. That brings us to the end of our knowledge dungeoneering and into, sadly, the end of our show. But we have one more segment to do before we wrap up. Kat, you want to explain it since it was your brainchild?
Sure. We are about to chance a random encounter. That's how watches work. You have a percentage chance that grows or shrinks depending on the circumstances of the watch your party has taken. So James and I will always roll for that. If we don't end up encountering anything, we'll just go and wake the fighter and call it a night, wish you all good luck. But if we do, we'll then roll on an encounter table, see what monster we come up with, and then say a few words about it, as James and I both really love classic D&D monsters.
Heck yeah. And that is a 3.
Haha! Okay, cool. So, good. That would have been terrible if we just woke the fighter.
Yes.
Also, who is our fighter? One day we'll find out.
Yeah, we'll find out.
Okay, so what list do you want to roll on?
I like magical beasts.
Magical beasts. Ha! Okay, I rolled a 59 on my percentile, which got us displacer beasts.
No, get out of town.
I'm not kidding.
All right, so we get to talk about displacer beasts. Displacer beasts are a monster I love to the point of having used them way too much, I think.
Way too much. Didn't your cat lady use them?
My cat?
No, she didn't.
No, she didn't.
She just had giant cats.
It would have been great if she could have used them, but they are magical beasts and sadly do not qualify as animal companions, and their CR was far too high for her to have one as a follower. But that's
okay.
Neither here nor there.
Displacer beasts, for those who aren't in the know, look like, kind of look like purple, large cats of prey, and they have on their back these two tentacles that have like rippy, grippy things on them and move autonomously. Their big thing is that they have this ability called displacement, which means that they are hard to see. They're moving in and out of the visible spectrum, and it's difficult to hit them.
Yeah. Displacer beasts are awesome. I think, generally speaking, it is a 20% mischance. Or is it 50?
It's 50. It's a 50% mischance.
Whew, man.
And they also have +2 resistance to ranged attacks.
So, displacer beasts. How do we want to rate and defeat these animals, I guess, is...
How about rate, defeat, and also improve? Let's always do that.
Okay.
Rate, I don't know. They're high up there on the list for me in that you can fight them from a pretty low level. I've had really realistic dreams where I've had to fight displacer beasts kind of because of how like low level and primary I think of them in terms of D&D monsters. So they're up for me. How do we want to... What about for you?
Displacer beasts are also very, very high up for me. I am going to say if I have a rating system, we'll just do 1 to 10 rating system on all these monsters. I'm going to call displacer beasts for me a 10 out of 10. I like them as far as animalistic monsters go. I like it because it provides this predatory threat that is also magical. It is something that is incredibly iconic, represents D&D to me. Like, I see a displacer beast, and I'm instantly thinking D&D. I also like the other applications that you have for them. I think one of my favorite displacer beasts ever that I saw was on Adventure Time.
Yes. He was really cool.
The one, like, and not only was he a displacer beast and cool, but he had that wonderful thing of having an approximate knowledge of everything.
Yeah, that was really well done. Well, that's giving it a knowledge score, which is a way to improve the beast. But I want to, so from my reading, I would give it a 7.5, I think. But they have this rivalry with blink dogs. Blink dogs and displacer beasts instinctively hate each other in the same way that kobolds and gnomes do. I love that. I think it's really funny whenever these non-asocial beings have just this irrational hatred of each other. It's very amusing to me. And people make use of that a lot when they introduce them into play. So that bumps it up to an 8. I think they're an 8.
Yeah. Yeah, for me, 10 out of 10 does not take that much convincing for me to love something. Kat, obviously thinking a little bit more critically.
Yeah, I don't even know what a 10 out of 10 is.
So
I have feelings about monsters. So how would you improve it? So you mentioned the Adventure Time one. Do you think that giving it an int score is the way to go?
Actually, no. I think the best way to improve a displacer beast is to take it out of D&D. I think if you really want an interesting game, take a displacer beast and put it in your Call of Cthulhu. It's not something that is going to drive someone insane, but in any low power game where you're not exactly dealing with a threat, as in terms of fighting it, a displacer beast is a completely terrifying monster. It's something that D&D, you know, is like really troped up and like, you're like, yeah, I'm a level 6 rogue. I can definitely handle a displacer beast. But if you're just a dude, faced with the displacer beast, you gain a whole new respect for the monster, and it's really cool.
And the monster didn't originate from D&D. It came from a 1939 short story. And in that, it was called, I think, a coat?
A coat?
And, yeah, like C-O-U something T.
Oh, it's pronounced jacket.
Got and the six-legged, I think then black, weird, tentacled cat creature was something that preyed on people's ids. And that is really cool to me. And I don't know why that element left the monster, because something I have problems with is lots of D&D monsters don't feel like monsters that could ever be at rest. I don't know what this monster gets up to in its downtime. I don't know why it's attacking the party, because rarely are predators in nature so hungry as to attack humans. It just doesn't, it's not often worthwhile for them, especially when adventurers have mountain swords, are good at beating your brethren up.
Well, I will say, in defense of these roving random monster attacks, humans are far from the most dangerous predator out there, and I feel like
that's absolutely true.
Deserve as much respect as a rabbit.
Oh, that's interesting. Maybe. I just think that after a while, you get to notice the signs of adventure, especially at a large cat level where tigers figured, like, tigers saw... You know, they realized they couldn't attack humans from the front, so we developed the masks and blah, blah, blah. It was kind of like a dialogue going back and forth.
Not everybody knows that neat factoid, and perhaps we should explain that. Tigers used to attack people specifically from behind. So humans, I think in India, developed masks that would go on the back of your head. So it would look like you're looking in both directions at once. It lowered tiger attacks for a while, but then they figured it out and started eating humans again.
Right. So the large predatory beasts there had sort of a dialogue ongoing with humanity. They definitely didn't think that we were threatening or beyond hunting, but they easily learned to recognize signs of people to not mess with fast. You know, that they're the plate mail is kind of an obvious sign. That looks like a shell. It's recognizable. There are things there that are just about certain things with monsters in D&D to me. But if this is a creature that goes after ids, them going after more intelligent beings makes sense to me, because we're more likely, I think, to have a developed darker id. You know, that it could add something really interesting there. And again, takes it out of just necessarily D&D. You know, you can do a lot with that. It makes sense in Cthulhu. It's a cool monster.
Yeah, I really think that's cool. Taking it back to basics and adding that sort of, I don't know. I think it actually makes it a monstrous element, because a grotesque thing, like, sure, that's scary and like it could kill you, but I think the coolest monsters are monsters that have some baggage attached to them, and they're actually specifically addressing a central fear or weakness in humanity. So, going after ids is really cool. Which brings us to defeat cat. I actually kind of like this idea, is now we have to put ourselves in a player perspective.
Uh-huh.
And let's say we are not the right level to handle a displacer beast by, you know, going up and beating on it. How do you defeat a displacer beast?
Well, I mean, what level are we? Oh, no. Well, we were probably never going to be good at walking up and beating on it, because last I checked, you're like a bardy rogue and I am a wizard or witch.
Well, I believe the art that we're probably using for this is Molly Ostertag's, so I would be a paladin knight.
So you're a paladin and I am a witch. So you should be able to just walk up to it and beat it.
But I am not high enough level, yeah. Or I'm going to miss it. Because of its natural ability.
Right.
So I think this is really strategies for play that allow you to take it on in different terms. And depending on your dungeon master and how they decide to rule things, they could help you and might not help you. I think controlling your environment is key, especially when dealing with any creature that you either cannot look at or have difficulty seeing. Perhaps encountering this creature in a field with knee-height grass, normally, like for something like a panther, a leopard, or tiger, that's a horrifying idea. But if it's a creature that is a little bit larger than those and would be moving through the grass, you'll be able to see where it's moving and be able to plan your attacks more carefully.
If you back that up with something like light, because they do have a +8 to hide. They're very scary in terms of hiding. I would probably first crack, make sure that our visibility is as high as it could possibly be. Something that I used to like to do with monsters like this is also tag them with something so that, like, you're not hitting the monster, you're hitting the blue glowing sigil that I have put on the monster. That'll keep our hits on target.
The other way of controlling the environment is instead corralling it into a contained space, going into a cave. If your cave is only so large and the beast is flanked, you can invent strategies that would, like, you know, in my mind, first of all, you're taking away from its AC. The displacement, the 50% mischance, is the really big thing. If you have a party member who's specifically spotting it, spotting which attacks are hitting, and rolling an aid another check to call out exactly where the monster is, if I were your DM, I would say, yeah, you managed to work around its hit chance by doing that.
And then in terms of spellcasters, you're still on the hook for ranged attacks. So remember that ranged touch attacks do not work like that, and break those out. It's rare to use them, but they are really handy when you need them.
Ranged touch attacks do not deal with mischance?
Not on them.
Really? Thematically, I don't understand why that would be true.
It doesn't get a +2 resistance bonus to save against any ranged spell or ranged magical attack that specifically targets it. Except for range touch.
Okay, so range touch still work as normal.
Yeah.
Okay. So that is where you're in for splash damage. You're absolutely right. Ranged attacks are key.
I think we probably handle it, though. It's not that spooky. Something that I like to do with these sorts of things, just summon swarms and let them go at it.
Yeah. Summoning monsters is another great technique. And swarms specifically just need to put a creature in their area in order to do damage.
Right. So you're hurting it 100%.
And if you're a sorcerer playing with the Dragon Magic book from 3.5, Power Word Pain, no brainer. You should obviously have that spell.
We shouldn't talk about 3.5 too much.
Power Word Pain!
Oh, God. And what was your stupid wing spell? That's not important.
That's Wings of Cover. We'll get there. It's great.
We'll get there one day.
Yeah.
Cool. So that was our random encounter. An exhausted witch and paladin make their way back to wake up the fighter.
Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for unlocking this through Patreon. We really appreciate that support. And be sure to check out our other shows, One Shot and Campaign, and obviously Critical Success is going to be returning as well. Thank you so much for listening. Until we camp next, heroes!